place great again.
Champions of the Big 12.
This is not the 1980s OSU.
Remember, always have faith in God, but have faith in yourself, and certainly have faith in the Cowboys.
Let her rip.
We are back at it. Welcome back to another edition of the Pistols Firing Podcast. I'm Carson Cunningham, joined as always by Colby Powell. Colby, happy British Open Sunday to you, my friend. How are you doing today?
Doing great, yeah. Watching the golf, it's stressful. There's a lot of guys still in it. There's like two holes left, but yeah, we're getting it in here on a Sunday afternoon. As soon as this is over, we're going to have a little footy this afternoon, the World Cup final. Lionel Messi, Lamine Yamal, good stuff. Good sports weekend.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sad the World Cup's coming to an end, and I'm even more sad that the dirty Argentinians are in the final. They play so dirty. They punched an English dude in the back of the head 3 minutes in. Not even a yellow card. Not even a VAR. England deserved to lose with the terrible substitutions they did. They parked the bus about 20 minutes too early, and I was texting with my dad, who's watched a lot of soccer since I played growing up. And he texted me even before the capitulation. He said, they're going to give up a goal. They are absolutely giving up a goal, if not more. And it's exactly what happened because they just capitulated. But see, I'm not a Messi fan. I know a lot of people are. I was always Team Ronaldo because he played for Manchester United. I certainly respect Messi's definitely in the GOAT conversation, all of those things. But I can't stand Argentina because they introduced the dark arts, is what we call it. The diving, the manipulating the referee at every turn, the dirty play. Like, they originated everything that's wrong with the sport. Back in, like, I remember watching the 1998 World Cup, England-Argentina. You had Diego Simeone. His kid played in this game and had five fouls in the first 30 minutes. It was just like deja vu. So I can't stand Argentina, but it's been an unbelievable tournament. And I actually went to the UFC fight last night. I kind of wanted to start there. But first, let's hear from Chris's University Spirit, your one-stop cowboy shop. Be sure to shop at chrisuniversityspirit.com all day, every day. Free standard shipping on orders over $75. Be sure to stop by Chris's over there on 244 South Knobloch Street in Stillwater. You know where they're at. Get the latest, greatest apparel, because I got to think Boone Pickens Stadium is going to be absolutely packed this year. I think people are just chomping at the bit to be relevant in football again. We are now a football school, unquestionably so. So stop by Chris's and start acting like we're a football school. Get geared up as we approach the season coming up here soon. We're getting into late July, into early August. That's when fall camp starts to get in full swing. We have a lot of football to discuss, a lot of football items related to Eric Morris and his program. But I kind of wanted to start at the UFC. I was able to go to the UFC fights last night in Oklahoma City at Paycom Center. My wife had some company tickets and was gracious enough to let me take the night off from the house, go with a friend of mine, Mike Jalousis, great, great dude. He and I aren't, he's not the biggest UFC fan. I used to follow this, Colby, pretty religiously coming out of college when UFC was starting to take off. You had Johnny Hendricks, who I actually went to high school with. Two of my best friends wrestled with him at Evan Memorial. I covered his championship-winning fight down in Dallas when he won the UFC title, but it's kind of fallen off my radar somewhat because the McGregor factor. Conor McGregor did a lot of wonderful things for the UFC in terms of making it more mainstream, but he's made it far less of a sport, Colby. Back when I started following it, they still have rankings and those things, but there was a clear ladder, and if you beat this guy and this guy and this guy, you were getting a title shot. Now it's kind of, well, if you're entertaining enough or you sell the fight well by talking smack, like it's become way more like boxing. But it was a star-studded night. It was a packed house. I was curious to see what the crowd would look like, and it was pretty much sold out. I saw very few empty seats. And a lot of Oklahoma State dignitaries were in it, Colby, but I had an epiphany as well. I am now officially an old man. So we had seats in the 100 level, which is where I like to sit at Paycom. You know, you're high enough to where you can get perspective and all those things. I looked around. I was the oldest person in my section by about 15 years, probably. It was all 20-something-year-old dudes. And I'm like, maybe I've outgrown the UFC. I don't know. But with that in mind, Colby, the night got off to a rough start. So me and my friend Mike, we get in our seats. There's a dude three rows behind us that just starts puking everywhere, all down the aisle.
Oh.
We're seated on the aisle, and he's three rows behind us. The guy right directly behind me had some on the back of his shirt. I think he was a human shield for us. And this stuff went like three or four rows down the aisle. I should have done a not safe for work cautionary disclaimer here, but that was a rough start. Now, the staff were amazing. They came and cleaned it up. Who knows where that guy ended? I think they wheeled him out of there and probably threw him in the drunk tank. But rough start.
Real quick, was he? He was throwing up because he was hammered. Like he didn't get food poisoning or something. Like this guy was hammered and puked on people.
Yeah, he didn't eat like a bunch of lettuce that's being, you know, giving people explosive bowel movements. Nothing like that. He clearly was hammered, and it was 7 o'clock on the dot. I don't know if he. Because the show starts at 4, because the undercard starts at 4. The main card starts at 7. We got there at 7. I presume he got there at 4 and was just pounding drinks. I don't know. Maybe he went to the pool all day before. I don't. How you get that gone at 7 p.m. is beyond me. But that was a rough start. But we fortunately were clean. Unfortunately for the guys behind us, they couldn't speak to that. But I will say it's pretty cool that, you know, the Oklahoma City Thunder, we all know, have turned this Oklahoma into very much an NBA city, NBA state. We love our professional sports, but we're still a college state and certainly a college town in Oklahoma City, because the biggest dignitaries that were there were Oklahoma State affiliated and Oklahoma affiliated. I think John Mateer, the quarterback for OU, and Danny Okoye, their defensive lineman, were there. But John Smith was in the house. Our friend Colby Daniels, who I know you've done radio with over the years, was there cage side covering the event. He had this great picture of John Smith and Daniel Cormier. Daniel Cormier, of course, was on the call. Legendary UFC fighter, legendary cowboy. And David Taylor was seated right next to John Smith at the arena. They showed him. And here were kind of my seats, Colby. This is where I was. No throw-up included in this picture, but that was the main event. So it was a fun night. And big ovations for the Oklahoma State dignitaries there. And you know, we mentioned it somewhat, I think, on this show. Diego Lopez is like one of the best fighters in the UFC. Like, he got mobbed. Like, everyone wanted a picture with him. And he's the fighter that trains with OSU up in Stillwater. So very much an OSU kind of feel in the building. They were kind of shown on the big screen, got big ovations, and certainly was a good night for the OSU contingent that were in the crowd.
Yeah, cool picture there of DC and John Smith. I'm not a big UFC guy. Occasionally, whenever I was younger, when I was in college and stuff, you know, we'd go to Buffalo Wild Wings if John Jones was fighting or something like that. He was kind of the big guy whenever I was in school, and everybody wanted to watch if John Jones was fighting. I haven't really been into it too much. I grew up on boxing. That was my love, and whenever it kind of faded and made way for the UFC, I never really made that transition. But very cool that Oklahoma City got that. Cool that you got to go and enjoy that. So how were the fights? Like, how was the night? Just how was the event in total? Good?
Like, the main card's only 5 fights, so that could go really wrong or really right. You never really know, especially when you get to the higher end of the card. These guys have a lot at stake. Their entire careers are at stake. But the first fight was like the fight of the night. They just went wild and it ended in a finish in the third round. That's probably the most entertaining fight. One of the female fighters got a really good submission and was really interesting too. I guess the UFC gives tickets to families somewhere in the arena, but they would bring them for the fight. If their family member was fighting, they would be just in the section over from us. So they'd be going nuts, like in the lead up during the fight. And you got to see kind of the tale of both sides. You saw the family when they won, you saw the family when they lost. It was like very visceral seeing people. Like, I couldn't imagine someone I loved and cared about stepping into a cage to fight in front of 19,000 people. But that was certainly interesting. And then the main event was two guys that they'll be in the Hall of Fame someday in the UFC, Kamaru Usman and Dricus du Plessis, which he's from South Africa. And Kamaru Usman's American, but he's of Nigerian heritage. And it was very 50-50. Like, half the arena was rooting for one, half was for the other. So it made for a really, I think du Plessis, the guy who ended up winning, who's probably going to be the next, he's already beaten the current champ twice. He talked about Oklahoma City's crowd. He was like, I think people in Vegas are getting spoiled. He goes, because here, this crowd brought the energy. They brought the juice. It was electric in there. So I think Oklahoma City really showed themselves well. And I think just kind of speaks to Colby, just kind of the college fandom we all have. I think we've brought that to the Oklahoma City Thunder, and now we've certainly brought it to, you know, the larger sports world as well.
Yeah, no doubt. That's very cool. I think Oklahoma City always shows well whenever we get a chance to host something like this. And yeah, that was a big event that came to town and got to play out at the Paycom Center. So yeah, that's awesome. Glad you got to go enjoy that. And yeah, that's I'm sure we'll get something like that back sometime if it was a big success.
Yeah, it was fun. Dana White actually showed up. The few I've covered in Oklahoma City, he rarely was there, but he was there last night and was taking pictures with OSU, OU dignitaries and all that stuff. It was pretty cool. So let's get to some Oklahoma State action here. You know, football is rapidly approaching, like I mentioned it. Mentioned off the top, and one thing you and I haven't really dived into a whole lot when we discuss Eric Morris and his program and what it's going to look like this fall. We obviously know he brings an offensive system with him, and he is the play caller. Well, at Big 12 Media Days, he was asked would he continue play calling duties, and he said, "quote It's still my favorite thing to do. There's nothing that still motivates me, keeps me involved in the game planning, keeps my brain activated, like trying to come up with different ways to attack people on the offensive side of the ball. Spend a lot of time thinking about it, calling people. There's not a ton of people who call plays left. That's probably what Lincoln and Riley and I talk about the most, is we are saving enough time on all these different parts of the organization when you're spending so much time calling plays. Well, I think you got to hire good people that you trust to do some other things. But yeah, it's what I love the most." What's your opinion on the head coach calling plays? Because I've gone back and forth over the years. You can certainly do it. Famously, Jimbo Fisher from Florida State, he won a national championship calling the plays. He's the first one that comes to my mind, being a Florida State guy. I'd have to think about the more recent champions if that were the case. Lincoln Riley has obviously not won a national championship. We all remember Mike Gundy sitting on the equipment trunk drawing up plays while the defense was out there, which was a weird look. But I do think staffs are bigger now, to where maybe that's not a big an issue, but I wanted to get your take on the head coach calling the plays while trying to manage the game.
Yeah, I think that if play calling is what makes the head coach special, I think that you've got to do it. I think that you've got to do what got you there, what is your bread and butter. You know, and if you do it for 5-10 years and all of a sudden it's not clicking and the game's evolved and it just doesn't seem like your stuff's working anymore and you want to move out of that role and bring somebody else in, I think that's fine. But very clearly, what has gotten Eric Morris to this point in his career, obviously he's great with people, he's very sociable, he's a good evaluator of talent and stuff like that. But he's a great offensive mind. He's a great offensive coach. He's a great play caller on Saturdays. So I listened to him. He was on with Ari and Andy on the On Three podcast, and he said on that podcast that he'll never give up calling plays. Like, he was asked about doing that, and he was like, "Yeah, that's my passion. It's what brings me to the office. It's what I love doing. I'll never give that up." Now, you say that year one. In the past, he's called plays at Incarnate Word. He's called plays at Washington State, North Texas, places like that, where he's not having to juggle the amount of people, the amount of responsibilities, the amount of donor obligations, like all of the things that he has to juggle at Oklahoma State. So I think that that's really easy to say, I'll never give up calling plays, whenever you've yet to even coach your first game at Oklahoma State. Maybe, you know, 4, 6, 8 years, he feels differently. But right now, yeah, I think that that's what makes him special. And I think if you put yourself in his shoes, all this pressure on him to carry over the success from North Texas to Oklahoma State, the idea that he would then give up control of that, of the thing that has gotten him to this point, yeah, I don't think that that would be reasonable at all. So you have to hire good people. You have to hire people you trust to go do their jobs, because he's not able to bounce around from meeting room to meeting room and oversee everything. He can't be just on top of everything Skylar Cassidy's doing on that side of the ball. Like, he's got to be in all of the offensive meeting rooms. He's got to be in with the quarterbacks. He's got to be getting all of these things put in place to have an offensive game plan and system for the season. And yeah, he's got to hire good people and trust that they're going to do a good job around him. And from all accounts, he's done that. And he certainly doesn't seem too stressed about it. He seems very relaxed and comfortable heading into his first season in Stillwater.
I completely agree that when you hire, whether it's an offensive coordinator or a defensive coordinator, who's like the best in the business, and they're the head coach, you make your program slightly worse when they're not calling the actual plays. I think that's why I never really had an issue with Lincoln Riley when I was covering them doing it. I will say, I think now with staffs, though, I think you do need, my number one hesitancy about it is the feel for a game when you have to call a timeout in a specific situation, when you have to manage the game clock, that's one thing that I don't think was one of Mike Gundy's greatest skill sets, was managing time, whether that's extending a half or closing it out. I do think now I would like to see kind of like an NBA model where Mark Daigneault, the head coach of the Oklahoma City Thunder, when he wants to challenge, he's got a challenge guy. And it takes that quick to know if he's challenging or not. I think, especially if OSU's on defense, how involved is Eric Morris while the defense is on the field? And if he's very involved with his offense while the defense is on the field, well, he needs somebody to be kind of the game manager or understand time, situation, because there is a nuance to that, Colby. You and I talk so much about it when college coaches get it wrong. That's the one caveat, because I'm with you. I think clearly he got the job by calling plays at North Texas. That's why he's here at Oklahoma State. That's what makes him special. And you don't want a lesser version of him calling the plays. But I do want someone on his staff to kind of be his Daigneault challenge guy when it comes to situational football, because that's the difference in winning and losing games, oftentimes in close games.
Yeah, I can get with that. I want to go in with an open mind about the idea that's something. Some coaches are great at it. Some coaches are not as good at it. Some coaches need that guy. Some coaches don't need that guy. And most coaches, I think, probably don't have a guy like that who's standing there telling them when to call timeouts and things like that. Maybe Morris will, maybe he won't. But I'm going in with an open mind and thinking, okay, let's give him a chance in year one. Let's see how he manages the clock. Because I do think, Carson, we've talked about this all summer, I think the difference between a 9-win season and a 6-win season this year is, like, you're going to have 5 games that are decided by less than 10 points. Like, can you win 4 of those? Do you only win 1 or 2 of those? Like, you've got to win your close ones, and timeouts can play a big role in that. You know, Gundy did some great things, obviously, at the end of games throughout his career. He also screwed that up sometimes throughout the end of his career. You mentioned at the end of first halves. Like, these are high-leverage moments in the game, and for that reason, I would hope that – it's either something that Eric Morris studies or he has someone on staff who studies it and is there to inform him and keep an eye on those things, because they are high leverage situations that can absolutely determine the outcome of games, which obviously then determines the outcome of season. So yeah, it's a big, big deal to get those things right.
And it's not really one or the other. Now that I'm thinking about it, you know, I'm sorry I keep bringing up OU, but Brent Venables is a good test case for this, because he was one of the top defensive coordinators in the country, became the head coach at Oklahoma. He initially was not the defensive play caller and royally messed up timeouts, game management, got it wrong 99% of the time in big spots while he wasn't calling the plays. And now he's calling the plays defensively as of last year and heading into this year. And maybe it'll be just as bad, if not worse. I don't know. But it's not to say that if you're not calling plays that you're just automatically get all that right. So that's something I think.
Yeah.
Eric Morris still is a young head coach. He's coached a lot of games as a head coach, but by all intents and purposes, he's a young coach. So there will be some sort of a learning curve in there. But Mike Gundy did have a great record in close games. As much as he liked to sit on the ball to end first halves and things like that, I do want to make that clear that we do appreciate Gundy's record in close games, because that really was the hallmark. One of the hallmarks of his tenure. But you mentioned the close games. I mean, we have the schedules have been kind of broken down nationally now that the schedules are out, and Oklahoma State sits 29th nationally amongst some of these rankings and second among Big 12 teams in conference schedule strength. For this reference, Texas Tech has the lightest schedule load. They're the consensus favorite to win the league. Cowboys are only favored in their season opener at Tulsa, and one of six Big 12 teams with an over-under of 5, and they are one of six Big 12 teams with an over-under of 5.5 wins. So that kind of shows you, I think the odds makers are kind of like us. We're like, we don't know who's going to be good. We don't know about these rosters, but I wanted to pull up these figures here. I had it right here.
Yeah. So while you find that, I'll just kind of clarify some of these rankings. So the College Football News has Oklahoma State. Yeah. College Football News has Oklahoma State at 29th in the country. ESPN's Football Power Index has Oklahoma State at number 44 in the country, third in the Big 12 behind Arizona State and Baylor. Look, Oklahoma State's schedule is obviously heavily bolstered by the fact that they have Oregon on there and they've got Texas Tech on there. So your two toughest opponents are both at home, but you got some seriously tough tests on the road too. So yeah, me and my dad actually talked about this the other day. I seen the top 20 strength of schedule and he asked me where I thought Oklahoma State was. And I said, you know, I don't know, probably 25th or 30th because of Oregon and Texas Tech. So I was kind of closer to the College Football News rankings than to ESPN's FPI rankings. But yeah, if you're watching on the YouTube, you can see Carson here has a Caden McFarland tweet pulled up. We love Caden. Oklahoma State football win probabilities according to ESPN's FPI. Tulsa, you know, a lot of these are really high. Oregon is 9.2% to win. Texas Tech is 14.2% to win. And then you've got these coin flip games that we've talked about all summer. Carson at West Virginia to open Big 12 play. You've got Colorado at home, at Iowa State, and Kansas at home to end the season. Oklahoma State sits just above 50% to win all four of those games that I just mentioned. They've got several where they're sitting right in the 30s. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of close games, I think, for Oklahoma State, unless they really exceed our expectations and start beating people by three touchdowns, and then we get to lose our minds a little bit.
Yeah, I think these percentages make sense to me. I think, especially when you go on the road, that those really can be coin flips. What are you celebrating on the YouTubes?
Ryan Fox just birdied 18. He piped a drive down the middle. He hit an iron to 10 feet, and he curled it in on the left side. Ryan Fox is your 2026 Open champion, denying Cameron Young of his first career major championship.
Wow. I mean, we haven't seen a putt to win a major in a very long time.
Ryan Fox, and he jarred it.
I know
he's not a big game, but he's got a reputation on tour as one of the genuinely nicest guys in the world. Cameron Young, heartbreak again. He opens major season with heartbreak at Augusta. He closes major season with heartbreak at Birkdale. Birkdale, throughout his history, is just littered with the elites of the elites claiming their open championships at Birkdale. And in sneaks Ryan Fox, 62-68 on the weekend, birdies the 72nd hole. Man, golf, Carson, sports, championships. Beautiful.
I would have liked to see Cam Young get a major. I just like to see the guys with pedigree, big names, win it. But Ryan Fox is a good dude. But Aaron Rye and Ryan Fox winning majors this year and Scottie Scheffler not winning one. Who had that on their bingo card to start the year?
Rory, wow. Aaron Rye, Wyndham, and then Ryan Fox. That might have been 10, 12 feet there for Ryan Fox. Jarred it, both arms go up in the air. Iconic moment. I know he's not a big name, but just a putt on the 72nd to win it, and the guy jars it. I love it. I love it.
Like I said, we haven't seen a putt to actually win a major since – when? I mean, Phil at Augusta was a long time ago.
Well, to clarify, are we talking about something outside like 3 feet? Because Rory in the playoff against Justin Rose had a 3-footer that he kicked in to win it. Are you counting that?
I mean, playoffs don't count. I mean, of course, those putts are to win. Okay. I mean, like on the course, this putt wins it or does not win it. And he makes it. We haven't seen that in a while. Gotcha.
Yeah, I can't think of the most recent one off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's been a while though. We've had a lot of great major winners, but they've mostly 18 has not really come into play a whole lot. But back to Oklahoma State, I do think it's interesting. CBS, this is kind of where I may be falling, Colby, as we get into preseason as far as what I think the win total might be. They project Oklahoma State at 9-3, wins at Tulsa, Murray State, at West Virginia, UCF, Colorado, at Iowa State, at Kansas State, Kansas, and Texas Tech. Losses, Oregon, at Houston, at Arizona State. But if you're going to – I didn't realize they had wins against Texas Tech in there. If you're telling me we're beating Tech, then I think we're handling business at Arizona State. That is not a hostile environment. Arizona State's a good program, obviously, under Kenny Dillingham, but I would like our chances in that game more than Tech at home.
Late game college football on the road, late season, pardon me, college football on the road, it just gets dicey. And that's why I look at that game against Tech. I think we've got a chance to beat Tech. I, I don't know how good they're going to be at that point. I don't know how good Will Hammond is. Obviously, the Sorsby stuff. I think Texas Tech's going to be really good, but they lost their two best defenders. You know, they lost the guy that was supposed to be playing for them at quarterback. I don't know that they're going to be some sort of crazy juggernaut who's unbeatable at home in November. You know, you get a dicey weather night. That probably favors Tech. We'd probably want a good weather night so Mestemaker can sling it all around the yard. But, yeah, and as far as Oklahoma State going on the road, like, I'm going to need to see this team prove some things on the road, too. But by that point in the season, we're kind of going to know, right? Like, you will have already been at West Virginia at that point. You have already been at Houston at that point. Like, Oklahoma State will have played some road games by the time they get to that one. So, yeah, I think that both of those games, Texas Tech and Arizona State, I think those are both winnable. I think they're both losable. Dude, I'm so ready for college football season to start. The more we talk about it, the closer we get. Like, I'm ready to get in the stadium, and I'm ready to get some data points on how good this team can be, because it's just everything this offseason is speculation based around pieces of information about, like, these different portals of players that are coming. And I don't mean the transfer portal. I mean, like, you've got this, let's call them a pod. We've got the North Texas pod. We've got the Oklahoma State returning pod. And then we've got this pod of guys from elsewhere, you know, Chris Barnes, Braylon Rigsby, these other guys coming in. And we're trying to guess how it all fits under a new staff against the schedule. And, like, I can't wait for that Oregon game. I don't think we learned much against Tulsa. I don't think they're very good. I have good reason, Carson, to believe that Trey Lamb is fully prepared for what comes his way in Chapman Stadium on September 6th, September 5th. But, yeah, I don't think we learned much that day. But I think we'll learn something against Oregon about whether this team, like, I mean, if that's a 45-34 loss, like, we walk out of that stadium feeling really good about ourselves.
Yeah, and I fully expect Oklahoma State to be competitive in that game. Look, am I picking them to beat Oregon? I doubt it, but I expect them to turn a lot of heads in that Oregon game. And you're right, I'm ready to get into it too. And I thought this was a really good article from Jenny Carlson in the Oklahoman. She kind of had like 10 of the biggest questions for Oklahoma State going into the offseason. We don't have to go through all of them, but some of the ones that stuck out to me. Number one is something we've speculated on for more than a decade now, is how good is the offensive line going to be? And while we can talk about it in generality, I think it's interesting that Morris brought three experienced offensive linemen with him from North Texas. They have four tackles who have all played more than 1,000 career snaps. Now, we all know Colby, offensive line revolves around cohesion. It's a unit. You know, you're only as strong as your weakest link on the offensive line, getting your quarterback hit. But she has that number one, and I kind of think that, along with just, I guess you could just say, the entire defense, what are they going to look like? I think those are the biggest questions for sure.
Yeah, and we know as Oklahoma State fans that just experience on the offensive line isn't enough. A couple of years ago, Ollie Gordon's final season, Oklahoma State brought everyone back on that offensive line, and we were raving about how, you know, we mustered up the NIL, and we brought back the entire line off of Ollie Gordon's Doak Walker Award-winning season, and we're just going to push people around, and Ollie's going to go nuts again, and it was a disaster. Those dudes spent 3 months just getting put on their backs as Ollie had nowhere to go. So just experience doesn't get it done. But Eric Morris has been very clear every time he's been asked about offensive line that he really values game reps. So I think it's on the play caller at that point, which is Eric Morris, to put them in a position to succeed. I think you and I were pretty clear under the last administration, if you will, that the offensive coordinator was not doing a very good job of putting guys in a position to succeed. Things were very vanilla. It was the phone booth offense. It was a lot of inside zone type stuff, and they were just getting blown up and pushed off the spot. I trust Eric Morris a lot more to put those guys in position to succeed, and him having guys with a ton of experience on the offensive line operating in his system, I have a lot more confidence in that than I think what we saw a couple of years ago that was just an absolute train wreck. So, yeah, I think the experience there is good. That group, Carson, they don't have to be a top five unit in the country. It's not what we're asking for. League average. Give us league average on the offensive line, because we know we're better than everybody else at quarterback. We know we're better than everybody else at running back. We know we're loaded at receiver. Like, just give us average on the offensive line, and I think we're going to be just fine.
Yeah, and, like, can you run the ball with any semblance of consistency? Even when they had Ollie Gordon, I mean, Ollie exploded for huge runs in a few games there down the stretch that first big season he had. But the we know we could not run the football consistently whatsoever, even with a guy like Ollie Gordon. So that to me, will be telling. If they can run the ball on Oregon, I think that will spell really good signs for the rest of the season for sure. And one thing we haven't talked about either that I hope we don't have to discuss this year, but it's something we've had to discuss every year since Taylor Cornelius was the quarterback at Oklahoma State. That is the last time an Oklahoma State quarterback finished the season unscathed without injury. Taylor Cornelius. What year was that? Was that
2018 was the year after Rudolph left.
2018, yes. That is a very long time. Part of that's having a running quarterback like Spencer Sanders, we all know. Part of that's having the offensive line, which we just discussed. But the backups in Stillwater right now are UMass transfer Grant Jordan, freshman Broderick Vares, and Luke Tepes. That's it. That's the quarterbacks on the roster. So, sure those guys work hard. Sure they would love to have the opportunity to play quarterback, but let's hope this is the first year since Taylor Cornelius that Mestemaker's not hurt. And I think that's where, if you're Mike Gundy, if you give Mike Gundy a little bit of grace, is they've had truly some terrible, terrible injury luck at the quarterback position. Now, last year was an unmitigated train wreck with the injury that started the game you and I were at with the kid transferred in from TCU, but let's hope this isn't a factor, Colby, but I do think that's worth noting on the historical context of where this program is year-to-date.
Carson, if this is not the last time that we discuss who the backup quarterback is between now and December, we all know we've got a problem. Like it all hinges on Mestemaker's health. If Wyatt Young goes down, I mean, dude, that's going to hurt. But I don't think it totally undoes your season. I think you can work around that. If Caleb Hawkins goes down, yikes, man, that would be brutal. But those positions, they're just a little bit more replaceable. Same if somebody goes down at any other position across the board. If your quarterback goes down, a guy who's like getting some buzz as a potential first round pick, like there's no replacement for that. You're not carrying around multiple first round picks on the roster. So it's just kind of the one injury that you can't have. It's like, you look at the Thunder. It's like Shea, that's the one injury you can't have. You can be competitive as long as that guy's out there. When Cade was at Oklahoma State that year, like if anybody else on that team would have gone down, so be it. If Cade would have gone down that year, it would have been a train wreck. They wouldn't want a game. So, he's got to stay healthy. If we're talking backup quarterbacks in the middle of October, we've got big problems and predictions go right out the window.
Yeah, and I think defense will have a big say in this. They ranked 112th in the nation, according to Pro Football Focus, in pass rush last year, just ahead of Delaware and Wyoming. Delaware. And combined with that, I think that question along with the secondary, I think it's going to be a big question. We all know they gave up a ton of big plays. You got Cale Smith back there, LaDainian Fields, Quentin Hammonds. A lot of those guys are going to have to step up and play really well in the back end because that as much as we harped on the offensive line, their secondary was one of the worst units in the history of Oklahoma State football. I'm very confident in saying that. The amount of chunk plays they gave up in the secondary over the last 2 years was about as bad of an output you can have from any one position on a football field. So I think Jenny wrote 10 questions. Those are really good. I really like and respect Jenny, and so I think those are some really good questions moving into the preseason.
Yes, those are fantastic. We'll get into more defensive stuff before the season. I think I did want to ask you. I brought up the Cade thing, and then my mind went to another place. Have you and I discussed the Boynton thing yet? It's been like 10 days since we recorded. Did we discuss that on the last show?
We discussed that when he got the interim job.
Dude, he's the head coach at Michigan. Oh, my God. That's amazing. Congratulations, Mike Boynton. I'm telling you, I went on The Animal with Sam Humphries the day that it happened, and I said, kids, if you treat people right in this world, you can go far. Like, people like Mike Boynton, Carson. That's what it comes down to. And he walked into another room full of regents and donors and high-level decision makers and convinced them to give him the head job at Michigan. Just awesome. Absolutely awesome. I hope at a place like that where he's going to have every resource in the world to be successful, I hope he absolutely crushes it. Because, yes, the wins and losses, he failed at Oklahoma State. Everybody loved him. He got dealt a bad hand. The NCAA sanctions were a joke. He was here through COVID. It was all a messy situation. Man, I'm rooting for him so hard at Michigan. And good on him. Just treat people right, kids. Treat people right.
He might be the best job interviewer who's ever lived. I mean, seriously, think about this. He was at the end of the bench on Brad Underwood's staff. Very few people knew his name when he got the Oklahoma State head coaching job. He walked into the OSU Regents coming off the heels of Underwood leaving town, convinced them to become the head coach, and then did what you just said with Michigan, who is coming off a national championship. I think Mike Boynton could run for president of the United States and have a shot. He is that. He must be that dynamic. He must go in there and give a TED talk on team building and relationship building and how to coach basketball, because I mean, I love Mike Boynton. I think he's awesome. He came on our show years and years ago when he first got the job. I have nothing but great things to say about the guy, and that's just super impressive. And I'm really happy for him because, look, I think he was dealt a bad hand at Oklahoma State. As much as I thought some of his coaching, there were some games that left you scratching your head, particularly late in games when their offense would bog down. You can break down all of those things, but he didn't really have a fair shot with what the NCAA did to him, with just the ridiculous ruling that came down on him. So really happy he gets a clean start. And I think he is one of those coaches who can really thrive in the NIL era. We know he can recruit with the best of them. So you give him the bag that Michigan's holding money-wise. I mean, he could, I mean, I think that was probably his argument. Look what I'm able to do at Oklahoma State and the amount of players I'm able to get there. You know, pre-NIL, and then, you know, now what I've done here at Michigan post-NIL. And so I'm really looking forward to watching him, and I'll be pulling for him. Anytime Michigan's playing and they're not playing Oklahoma State, obviously I'll be pulling for him.
Yeah, me too. I think it's awesome to have him up there. And I think he would tell you that he still has a lot of love for Stillwater, and he still has a lot of love for Oklahoma State. I think he enjoyed his time here. And yeah, I think he has a lot of love for us. We have a lot of love for him and wish him the absolute best. We also have a lot of love, Carson, for Echo Contracting. Echo Contracting is a proud sponsor of the pod, offering electrical contracting services throughout all of Oklahoma. They pride themselves on high quality professional jobs done right the first time. Call or text for a quote today, 405-279-8444, or email info@echo-contracting.com. Echo Contracting. Carson.
Appreciate that.
School, goodbye. Tough week for folks.
I mean, our boy Victor Hovland, what happened? Missed the cut? I added Ricky Fowler to one of my pool teams this week. He was playing well coming in. He's a good British Open player. Eugenio Chikara, nowhere to be found. He missed the cut, I presume. I haven't seen his name this week.
He made it. Yep. So he did. I think I got them all. Yeah, I think I've got them all here. So I'll give you the quick rundown. I've got seven names here for you. Highest finisher, best finisher, Rasmus Nergard Pedersen, 5-under for the week, T9. Ricky Fowler shot 66 today, Carson, finished T18. Alex Noren shot 68 today, finished T18. Chikara shot 69 today, finished T46. And missed cuts at 2, 3, and 4 over, respectively, are Sam Stevens, Wyndham Clark, and Victor Hovland. So the three names that you probably would have made the argument coming into the week, best chance to have a high finish, all missed the cut. Rasmus Nergard Pedersen, the best of the bunch.
I tell you, Nergard Pedersen's turned into like a better pro than I feel like he was in college. You know, he was very highly touted at OSU and didn't do a ton, didn't win a bunch of tournaments, didn't really fulfill a lot of that promise I think he had as a recruit. But some guys are that look at Sam Stevens, like you just mentioned. He was the sixth guy on that national championship team, and he's having a better pro career than a lot of guys that were in front of him on that roster. And Chikara is wearing a Swingin' Pete polo with the Big 12 emblem on the sleeve. He's still wearing like his college gear, which I just love. Never graduate.
It's the same clothes. Like I swear Chikara, it's just like he got given these shirts whenever he was in college at Oklahoma State, and he's like, yeah, I'll just wear these. I mean, he's a pro. He's won like two or three times on the DP World Tour this year, and he's still just rocking the free shirts he was given in college. It's amazing.
He literally just took his game-worn polo from college, took it to the embroiderer and said, put my sponsors here and over here because we got the Big 12 and Swingin' Pete here. So this is where we're going to have to go. It has to be on these shirts, which I just love. Yeah. I love that he's still repping after, you know, he's been out of college a few years now. And some of those other guys could rep it a little harder. Like, you know, if we want to consider Wyndham Clark, a lot of people put to me on one of our previous shows when we were debating Wyndham Clark's allegiances to Oregon versus Oklahoma State. A lot of people replied to me and said that you got to have Swingin' Pete on the bag if you're going to be claiming OSU. That kind of comes with the territory. So I love that he still reps Swingin' Pete. But disappointing year for Victor Hovland, you got to say, right? I mean, really,
yeah.
He contended somewhat this year, right? PGA.
I mean, he salvaged disappointing major year, no doubt. He salvaged his season by winning the Travelers. Had he not won the Travelers, the whole season we'd be looking at and being like, gosh, Victor, true. Find something. He salvaged his season. That was a big win. He took down the number one player in the world in the playoff Monday morning, like did the row chant with the Norwegian fans. Awesome, awesome moment of the season on the PGA Tour. He missed the cut in three out of the four majors, Carson, and just, I mean, his game looked pretty unserious at the biggest tests of the year. And that's how I would describe the way he played Thursday and Friday. He was 200 through seven on Thursday in some of the easiest conditions of the week. And then he just limped home with a couple of bogeys. And then he goes out Friday afternoon in the tough conditions and shoots 74. And it just was a very unserious 27 holes of golf from Victor Hovland after that start on Thursday. And, you know, he's always searching. He's always looking for that next big thing to make his game click. He's a tinkerer. He's an experimenter. And he needs to find something. Obviously, there's a lot of golf left to be played this year. It's a non-Ryder Cup year. So he's really got about 1 month of big-time golf left with a chance to go to the playoffs, go to the FedEx Cup, and make some noise at the end of the season. And then he's going to have a decent little offseason here. And he needs to do some of that experimenting and just find some way to tap into that game, that ball striking, just what he had going at the end of 2023. Something, man. He's got to find something. He's too talented to be missing the cut at three of the four majors throughout the season.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I do think, yes, he got a win. That's an important caveat from you. That doesn't make it a total failure. But let's face it, Victor is widely considered the best player without a major. Maybe Cam Young probably has surpassed him now with the major season he had this year. But Victor is certainly number one or number two on that list. And my hope is he doesn't – we all just presumed Ricky Fowler would get a major at some point, especially coming off that year he finished in the top five in all four majors in 2014. And it didn't happen for him. And you look at all these charts – like No Laying Up posted a lot of the charts of guys who've been, they were discussing Tommy Fleetwood and how certain guys in Fleetwood and Fowler was above him in like major finishes and all those things, but it was like Lee Westwood, Ricky Fowler. Easily the data said, these are the two best players who didn't win a major, and Fleetwood was climbing toward that list. My hope is Victor doesn't end up on that list, and he's still young for all intents and purposes in his career. But to miss the cut in three or four, you have to consider a disappointment, no doubt.
Yeah, so he's 28 years old. He'll turn 29 in September. Yeah, he's still plenty young. I mean, he'll play high-level golf, I would think, into his low to mid-40s. So what's he got, another 60 majors to have a chance at? But the longer you go without one, the more the pressure ramps up. And, like, we see Aaron Rye and Ryan Fox win major championships this year. Those guys don't go into major championships with any pressure. Like, they don't go in with expectations. They get on a heater and it's like, oh, nice little story here. But, you know, obviously they're feeling pressure to get it done because it's a life-changing moment. But all of the outside noise, that weight of like the golf community on your shoulders to get it done and get it across the line, like, it's not there for an Aaron Rye or a Ryan Fox. And those guys just put in incredible performances to win their first major championship. Victor's got to do that with all the chatter around, okay, you're obviously a great player, but can you get it done in this moment? So, I want to see him get it done. Obviously, I still am halfway holding out hope that Ricky can sneak one of these open championships in toward the end of his career. But, you know, he's getting up there a little bit in age. How old is Ricky now? He's got to be in his mid to late 30s, I would think. 37, he'll be 38 in December. So, I mean, he can play high-level golf another 5 to 8 years. Gives him another 20 to 30 majors possibly to sneak one in. We certainly don't think he can win the Masters. He's not long enough. U.S. Open setups seem like, I don't know, LACC was a really good recent performance for him there. So the Open seems like his best chance. I'd guess Ricky will have 5 to 10 more real chances in his career. We're going into the week. You'd think, okay, if he got hot, this could be a Cinderella story.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, we thought Ricky was young at one point too. Hope we don't have to have the same conversations about Victor, but we shall see. I got to get your opinion on the Bryson DeChambeau circus that was on Friday. One of the weirder, wilder Fridays I can ever remember watching a golf tournament. For people who aren't aware or under a rock, I mean, DeChambeau hits it into waist high, if not chest high, fescue, way off the planet. He very clearly stomps it all down behind the ball to give himself a swing. He evaluated it, could tell he didn't have a swing, and starts just stomping everywhere immediately. Does it repeatedly, gets a penalty, threatens to not play in the third round. He's so upset with the ruling. They drove him back out to the fifth hole where it occurred and made him like reenact it. It was just a wild scene. And Bryson, being the petulant, spoiled little brat that he is, decides to hit balls in the pitch black and keep all the volunteers waiting, all the staff waiting, and delayed tee times for the rest of his playing competitors, the field. Guys who had been up since 3 a.m. didn't have their tee times until like 11 o'clock at night, not knowing when they were teeing off, nothing. He held the tournament hostage. And it's amazing to me how many people were defending Bryson in this. Like, look, if you want to argue that other players do it and that the rules aren't properly enforced, I think that's the main issue. Is the PGA Tour lets guys get away with stuff every single week on tour. That's not the discussion. The discussion is Bryson cheated, essentially. He broke a rule and got rightly penalized for it. I thought what Rory McIlroy had to say was just tremendous. Like, I didn't think he had to throw in there he doesn't care for Bryson, because we all know that, but I think he was just giving context that his comments are somewhat biased a little bit. But he's right. He absolutely knew what he was doing. Anyone with a brain cell can see he's doing that on purpose to improve his lie. And he got caught red-handed. And I think his reaction tells you he got caught red-handed. Like, the fact that he went through all that charade afterwards was just typical Bryson. And the moment things do not go this guy's way, his YouTube PR facade goes away and his true colors come out. And his true colors are he's a jerk behind the scenes. I've heard that from many people that have involvement with the PGA Tour. His playing peers can't stand the guy. They were very happy he left for LIV. And I was a little surprised that Max Homa, people like that, Russell Henley came out in defense of Bryson, but I think they were coming at Colby more from the lens of, hey, like, this kind of stuff can happen, and the fact that Bryson got singled out isn't really fair was kind of the sentiment I gathered from them. But what was your take on it?
So to just address the argument that, well, this is happening to somebody without a camera on them and they're not getting penalized, I think it's a terrible argument, because what you're telling me then, the argument you're making is, okay, if we get someone on camera and we can tell they are clearly breaking a rule, we should not penalize them because someone else might have gotten away with something along the way. Like, if I get pulled over going 82 in a 65, I can't just be like, officer, pause, you can't give me a ticket. Down the road, a guy passed me, he must have been doing 87, and you didn't get him, so I'm sorry, you can't give me a ticket because that guy didn't get one. That's not how it works. Like, if you get caught breaking a rule, you get caught breaking a rule. There has to be a penalty there. Like, and I can't remember who it was, all the NBA stuff and the Jaylen Brown stuff was happening, everybody's like, his feelings are hurt and all this stuff. Said, that's what the money's for. Like, Bryson, you're famous. You're rich. You're probably going to be a billionaire one day. You've got all these followers on YouTube. People love you. You've got cameras on you all the time. You know that you have cameras on you all the time. If we want to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that it wasn't intentional, whatever. I think he was very clearly trying to help himself without just like being, I mean, he was stomping around like an elephant back there. Just, he looked ridiculous the way he was stepping around. Also, just the sheer size of Bryson, I think, made it worse. Like, if Ricky is out there and you know, small little Ricky or Spieth or one of these guys that's not that big is back there in the weeds, maybe it doesn't look as bad. Bryson's like this behemoth of a human being back there just, like, clodding around in the deep grass. So, yeah, anybody who listens to this podcast probably knows how we feel about Bryson DeChambeau. The stuff afterward was so ridiculous. And the fact that any real media people even entertained the idea that he wouldn't play the next day, I thought just played into his hand and gave him the attention that he was seeking. He was obviously always going to play. That he was never going to withdraw from the Open Championship because he got a two-shot penalty. But yeah, obviously he handled it very poorly. I thought Rory's comments were great because I think their rivalry is great for the game of golf. They don't like each other. It's not like Rory said, look, the guy's a D-bag and I hate him. He said, and I quote, I'm not particularly fond of him. Like, it's not like it was just the most scathing indictment ever. I'm not particularly fond of him. I don't feel the need to defend him. Like, yeah, I was fine with what Rory said. Scotty said that he had a lot to say, but he was focused on the golf. Now I want to hear what Scotty has to say. I want to hear his thoughts on the whole ordeal. But Yeah, he deserved the penalty. You can't just not penalize him because somebody else somewhere on the golf course might have improved their lie at some point throughout the week and didn't get caught. We had clear video evidence of Bryson trampling the grass around his ball, his line of his swing, like an elephant. He's a clown. I don't root for him. I think he's great for the game of golf, though. I think he's great for the game of golf. I think he's the content king. The content just finds him, Carson, and it finds Rory and his quotes. Like, please let us get Bryson and Rory in another major championship showdown. Please let us get Bryson and Rory in a Ryder Cup singles match. Like, everything about this rivalry is going to be so, so good for the game of golf over the next 10 years.
And look, I know a lot of people listening to this show probably don't like Rory. I hear from them all the time when Rory comes into my Twitter feed and I retweet something about him. I understand if you don't like Rory for things he's done in the past, Ryder Cup, whatever. But at least Rory, this is why I like Rory, is he will not sugarcoat things. He's not Scotty who's like, oh, now's not the right time to share my opinion. Like, Rory doesn't care about the blowback. He's going to speak his mind. He's going to be transparent. And he said what a lot, and I mean a lot of golfers in that locker room think, that Bryson cheated, he got caught red-handed, and he acted like a baby about it. And that's essentially what Rory said. He kind of shied away from him. He's like, look, I don't know Bryson's intent, but it didn't look good. And it certainly did not look good. And so if you don't like Rory, that's fine. But at least he doesn't care about the blowback and will call a spade, essentially. And for the people that argue, like, well, his shots are on TV. Yeah, these are the most he's on the leaderboard. These are the most consequential shots of the tournament. So we don't care.
Carson, all the reason to be more careful with how you are stomping around your ball in the high grass, because you know every shot's on camera.
Well, and I don't care if Christopher Raitan, who's five shots off making the cut, is over there stomping around like an elephant. Like, yeah, he should be penalized too, but it's not televised because it's not consequential to the golf tournament. He's not trying to win the thing. And so, yeah, guys who are on the leaderboard are going to get watched closer. Sorry, not sorry. But I think, once again, Andy Johnson, I think, is the smartest person in golf. He basically made it more about the PGA Tour has enabled these guys to manipulate the lie in their golf ball for a very, very long time. The guys will take a 3-wood out, mat the grass behind it, then end up hitting irons. So they can get an iron on the ball. The list goes on and on and on and on of what these. I hope that this thing that happened with Bryson, they start penalizing guys more often, because Colby, every other sport, there's penalties. These guys don't fear any penalty at all. They feel like they can do whatever they want and they'll get the benefit of the doubt. And that's why Bryson was so upset, is that's typically the case. But he was too egregious with it. He just really was. So look, I'm sure people can't stand Rory and think we're just Bryson haters, but I judge the book by its cover and its content within it, and that's Bryson. That's just who Bryson is. And I think people that have fallen for this shake, like high-fiving everybody and being on YouTube, like Bryson, when he was wearing the Ben Hogan cap, was the least liked guy on tour. When Brooks Koepka was putting him in a locker, no one could stand Bryson. I commend him for the PR turnaround he's done to be well-liked, because he was the most loathed publicly. Now it's just, more privately, because he's done this PR campaign.
Yeah, well said. He just, I thought he made a fool out of himself this week. And look, I don't expect everyone to agree on that, because nobody, like, we all don't agree about anything. There's nothing in the world that we all agree about. If you're a Bryson fan and you're mad, that's fine. But I don't care. I thought he made a fool out of himself this week. And he had a disastrous major championship season. Carson, I was really bummed that Bryson even made the cut this week, because I wanted him to miss the cut in all four majors and we could start calling it the Bryson Slam anytime a guy does that. But it just ended up being 3 out of 4. So now he just matched our boy Vic. Our boy Vic and our boy Bryson.
Yep.
Tough scene.
You don't want to be in that group, that's for sure. But Colby, enjoyed it. I'm heading up to Tulsa next week during the first part of the week, so probably a show later in the week. And that's good timing. We lost Colby. So appreciate everyone watching, and we'll chat with you next week on the Pistols Firing Podcast. As Colby would say, go Pokes.